As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest, that means march, that means disturb the peace, that means jail, that means risk, and that is hard. We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking, we're demanding. Give us the vote.
Give us the vote.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is senior editor, Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Today we will be talking about three films, Selma, Inherent Vice, and American Sniper. We're going to start with my favorite of the three, and I think, Adam, it's your favorite of the three as well. I believe it was your favorite film of 2014.
That
Selma.
Is correct.
Yes. Selma is a very powerful film, and it's an unexpected film as well. I think Selma, a film that I think I was expecting it to be, and I don't like... I'm trying to get out of the habit of judging films for what they're not. It's like, thank goodness it didn't do that. And yet, at the same time, I think it's good to play against its expectations. And what I expected from Selma was, and Martin Luther King Jr. saved the day for everyone. And wasn't that simple? We can wash our hands of it, and civil rights was never a problem again. And thankfully, that is not this film. This film is much harder to watch. It is much harder not only in the visuals of it and what it portrays, but also in the complexities of the theme. I don't think this film is a hagiography, and I really respect that. And I would also say that I think something that has created a backlash to it, because there must always be backlash. What is the internet without backlash? Is
you mean what is the Oscar season without backlash?
Don't
mistake it for a calculated effort.
True, but I mean, I was reading this New York Times piece where the author openly noted Oscar campaigns and just said, and I just want you to know that's not why I think this film is awful, because it's historically inaccurate. Because we're still hung up on the fact that films must be historically accurate, because won't someone think of the lazy children? The lazy children and their lazy teachers who can't be bothered. It's like, why... Lyndon Johnson does not come off well in this film. I'm like, oh no, not Lyndon Johnson. Anyone but Lyndon Johnson.
He comes off as a politician. I genuinely don't understand it. Exactly. I don't think he's portrayed in a bad light. When politicians take office, they have a list of things they want to get done. He was going to do the Voting Rights Act, but it wasn't at the top of his list. He wanted to do other things first, and it was just a battle of, like, you know, this can wait, can this wait, or does it need to go now? And, like, you know, I've got my agenda, I've got my plans, I've got people battering me about things to do. That's not like a, it's not portraying him as like a racist or like, I don't ever want to.
He does drop the N-word. He does drop the N-bomb.
Well, it was 1963. So.
That is true. It's still the N-bomb.
Yes.
Any time of year, it's still the N-bomb. I don't sit back and watch 12 Years a Slave and be like, okay, yeah, I can see it. I can't hold Michael Fassbender accountable for that. But
true.
I will say, here's the thing. I acknowledge that, yes, there are historical inaccuracies in Selma. To get hung up on them is to miss the larger themes of the film, which is, just to go to the story of Lyndon, what happens with Lyndon Johnson. Even if that isn't precisely what happened, what the film is getting at is to simply rely on political figures, even the most powerful political figure in the country, and wait on them is a poor idea, because the impetus to create change must come from the people, and it must come in more than one fashion. And I think, again, with many things with regarding Selma, I think Selma isn't trying to be modern in the sense of, like, I am creating a straight commentary on today. Something I find very powerful about Selma is that it is evergreen. But I do think what it's saying is we can't just sit back and just hope that politicians do things for us. And I think having Lyndon Johnson in that role as he's depicted plays into the complexities of this story.
Yeah, it serves a purpose. The movie is almost it's almost like a procedural. Like, this is not a biopic. This is not, and I think even categorizing it as a biopic is false. It's a movie about process, really, about how does change happen? Like, how is change actually enacted? Well, it takes strong leaders. It takes complexity. It takes difficulty. It's not easy, and it doesn't last always. And I think it shows the truth in that of the perseverance through it. And it's not kind of like, you know, if kids are reading a history book, they're like, and then black people didn't have the right to vote, and then Martin Luther King marched, and then they could vote, and that's how they learned how to vote. Like, that's it's not that simple. And I think this movie kind of opens up not only how this happened, this particular instance, but how all change occurs and why it is necessary for people to come together as a community. Like, you even see in the film, it's not possible for just the black people to march. Like, that's not how change couldn't happen that way. They needed help. They needed, you know, outside effort, and they needed people to pay attention. They knew that people in the country would kind of say, hey, this isn't right. This isn't an inherent thing that, like, oh, everyone in the country is against black people voting. You need other people to recognize what's going on. And so you need the press. You need all kinds of different things. And what's amazing about this film is it was shot before all of this stuff happened, all of the, you know, Ferguson and all these terrible, terrible things that happened in the world. And yet it feels so now, it feels so present. And I think that's a testament to Ava DuVernay's direction, and that she portrayed it. She wasn't simply interested in telling the story of the March to Selma. She was interested in telling a story of now, the world we live in. And it feels present. It feels relevant without, you know, title cards that say, and this is what happened in the future, or just...
We now call them computers.
Yeah, oh God. That title card.
That's from Imitation Game, for those who don't know. I will say this about Selma as well. I think it is a film about now, but I think the way it incorporates Dr. King is to show that the importance of a strong central figure.
Yeah.
Because I think while it does certainly reflect current events, even though it was filmed before Ferguson and Eric Garner and current events that spark protest, I think it also shows that affecting change is more difficult, not just because of the media age we live in, because in the 1960s you had three channels and they're all showing the same thing, and what else you don't really got a lot of other distractions other than work and family. You don't have to be like, man, I gotta update my Facebook and my Twitter and all this. You don't have all these different avenues of what I believe are slacktivism. You know, I'm upset on Twitter, which is fine. It's good to incorporate those things. But I think that what Selma's showing is that it takes not only a groundswell of even people going on the ground, even protesters physically on the scene. I think it takes central figures, and I think even before this, I'm thinking about the Occupy Wall Street movement, which kind of fizzled because it was a bunch of people upset, but with no common purpose. And I think that while there was a generally agreed upon thing, and I think Ferguson certainly had a very precise aim, when you have no central figure, and a central figure like Dr. King is rare, and that's why we should treasure him, and that's why he is such an important figure in history. But at the same time, this isn't just about him. He didn't create this. He was part of it, and he was a leader, but a leader is only a part of the larger movement.
Yeah, and I was genuinely surprised to see that it's a complex portrayal of Dr. King. It's not, I mean, and I don't mean not only does it get into like his infidelity and trouble with his marriage, which are actual things that happen and are dealt with in the movie, but he's not infallible. He's not, you know, always optimistic and hopeful and has a dream. He gets discouraged. He gets scared. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what they're fighting for. He doesn't know if it's going to turn into anything. He can't see, you know, 10 steps ahead. What is this going to do? Like, what actual change are we going to affect? And I think that's important, because I think sometimes people see hero figures and they're like, well, that's not me. I mean, I'm not strong enough to do that. But it takes a human being. Like, a leader is a human being. It's not a superhero. It's not someone who is able to just kind of ignore pressure and all kinds of stuff like that. So I think that's super important and super brave. And David Oyelowo's performance is fantastic and layered and raw. I applaud the film for going there and for keeping the focus on that kind of figure, that kind of portrayal.
For sure. And I think it understands that you can make someone heroic without being saintly.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, as I said, and as we've both said, saints are boring. And if you put Dr. King on this sort of higher level, which, by the way, we all understand that he was one of the great figures in history. No one's going to go out and dispute that. What's important is to humanize him, because when you humanize him, you humanize the events, you make them more real, and that's more important. Because if you just single him out as this extraordinary figure who is above all mankind, then what hope do we ever have of ever? He's like, well, he was superhuman, and we don't have any superhumans. And it's like, no, we have people who experience doubt. We have people who are fearful and complicated and flawed. And the question is do you overcome that? Like, what does it take? The greatness comes from pushing through those things rather than being like, I was perfect from the word go. And I think that makes a more compelling narrative, and I think that makes a more compelling message. And I have to say, when I saw this film, and I was like, one of the moments I was on the edge of my seat, I'm like, are they gonna save the infidelity? Because to me, like, that was the turning point of the film, from it telling me what it was going to be. Because I felt that the King estate has been very, very protective. And I understand why. I mean, they, you know, there is an image here. And to say that this amazing figure cheated on his wife, that kind of could be, oh my God, I have to hold two ideas in my head at once. But when they said it, and they weren't overt, they didn't make it, it wasn't like a central conflict, but they said it basically, and it was there, and they just let it be there. And I thought it was executed perfectly, and it told me this is the kind of mature, thoughtful film we are watching right now.
Yeah, it's one of the many layers of the film. And God, Ava DuVernay's direction is incredible. The Edmund Pettus set piece, it is a set piece, is so expertly crafted and executed. And I think they shot it over like 2 days or something. It's incredible. It's moving and it's powerful and it's unlike anything you've seen before. It puts other movies to shame. You can ask like, what does the director do? What is the importance of whatever? It's that. It's putting it. I mean, you read on the page, you know, and then the protesters were beaten down by the police. But just the way she crafts it and the way she puts it together, you know what's coming, and she builds that tension. And together, the cinematographer Bradford Young, who is now like one of the cinematographers to watch between this and A Most Violent Year, God, it's fantastic.
It really is. And I think, to me, if there was a breakthrough director this year, it has to be DuVernay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, I get it. Like, you know, there's Morton Tilden, his Invitation, but like,
Damien Chazelle.
Damien Chazelle, great, you know, also very good. There were a lot of good breakthrough directing thing, you know, for this year. But I think DuVernay kind of just, I think she took the biggest gamble. Like, Whiplash, here's the thing. If Whiplash fails, it's an indie that fails. I mean, that's the thing. It would be just another Sundance film that just didn't catch fire.
Yeah, it's on your Netflix instant watch. It's something that's like, hey, it's something to check out.
Exactly. This film is the first major film with Dr. King as a central character. That's huge on its own. And then you have these major events this film was going to get attention. Like this, and yet, I feel like this film isn't as getting as big as it should be. I feel like it is and it isn't. I don't know. I feel very.
It's crazy. It seems crazy.
It feels like a film like everyone should be talking about right now.
Yeah.
And I people keep asking me like, "Oh, is Selma good?" I'm like, "It's really good. You should totally see Selma." People are interested in it, but people aren't talking about it in a way that I think they should be. And I think that you can chalk that up to maybe poor marketing on Paramount's part, or it's just.
I think the marketing's been bold.
It's just
people, it's an expectations thing, and I think you could say the same thing to a lesser extent about Wild, is that people think they know what kind of movie it is and kind of like, oh, I know what that is, and I'll get a history lesson and I might tear up and that'll be that. But it's so special and it's so much more than that, and I don't know, it's so weird because the critical support has been overwhelming. I mean, it had 100% on Rotten Tomatoes until the day it expanded wide, and 2 negative reviews is all. And critics went nuts for it, and it's been crazy. I'm just kind of, I don't know. It's strange. It's odd. We should note that we are recording this before the Oscar nominations are announced, if you're listening to this afterwards. So we don't know if it will have some surprise presence there, or if it will also be ignored. But yeah, it's just weird that people aren't talking about it as much as they should be.
I'm also concerned if maybe this is just a product of short attention span culture, whereas right before Selma came out in December, you know, it's like, oh wow, these, you know, there's Ferguson is recent, and then the Eric Garner, like there were events that were very much reminding us, and then we just moved on. It's like, oh, and now like Sony's being hacked and The Interview is being prevented from coming out, and then it's like events, like our world just keeps moving so fast, and it's like what was relevant today isn't relevant anymore, except Selma is constantly relevant and
yeah.
Constantly be paying attention to it.
Will always be relevant.
Exactly. I think that's one of the things. Like, yes, there were current events recently that certainly tie into what we can draw parallels, for sure. There are some very clear parallels. The thing is those parallels are always there. It's just not – it's a matter of headlines. And I think that, to me, once the headlines fade – the situation isn't gone, and I feel that it's another reason why I think Selma will persevere as something that ties into larger issues, even if you want to dismiss it as this is not an accurate historical document. The fiction film is not entirely true.
But even beyond that, it's just an incredible film. Like, even beyond the relevancy and all of that stuff, it's just a fantastic movie, like fantastic performances, brilliant direction, wonderful cinematography, you know, great use of popular music, which is really hard to do in a movie. You got to be really talented to figure out what pop songs to put in there and stuff. But I think they're done really well, especially with the Edmund Pettus Bridge set piece. I mean, it did okay when it expanded wide box office wise. It got an A+ cinema score, which is very, very rare. So it seems like the people that are seeing it are loving it as much as most other people, though I did. I went out to see it, and I was leaving the theater, and I overheard a guy talking with a group of people that he was with that saw it, and there's some girl that was with him was like, "Was it? Did you like it? What'd you think?" And he was like, "It was okay." He was like, "It's just when I think of movies, I think funny." And the girl was like, "But this is history." And I was like, "Are there really people out there who are only okay with movies that are like enjoyable and funny?"
I gotta say, Adam, not enough laughs in Selma.
Not enough laughs in Selma.
Could have
12 Years a Slave, pretty funny. But Selma.
Pretty funny. Got some good laughs.
Selma, not enough laughs.
Oh, God. I'm not even gonna end that 12 Years a Slave route.
it's just
I'm
like
not,
really.
I'm not Eric Snyder and his Randy Newman marriage.
Yeah. Oh, God. yeah, but it's just. It's odd. And that makes me feel like maybe some people think that seeing Selma is a chore, but like it shouldn't be. Like, this is why we can't have nice things. This is why studios are trying to make only 4 quadrant movies that have spectacle and action and humor and a little bit of emotion and a love story.
Yeah. And the thing is that There are some films where I understand. Like, 12 Years a Slave is a hard watch.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people that wanted to see it, and they're like, but I'm not really in the mood. And I'm like, you're probably never going to be in the mood for 12 Years a Slave. Like, let's be fair. But by the same token, like, there are other great movies where, like, you know what? The Godfather is, like, not really, like, a pop-on-and-play film. It's
no.
3 hours. But that doesn't mean it's not worth watching. I'm not saying 12 Years a Slave is as good as The Godfather. But it's that same kind of, like, not every movie is something that you just want to play in the background and have a good time. And that's okay. And I think that with Selma, I have to say, between the two, if we're going to draw the parallel between 12 Years a Slave and Selma, Selma is a much easier watch.
I mean, it's uplifting is the thing, is that it's yeah. inspiring. It's seeing, like, this happened, and, like, change happened. It was an impossible situation, and it felt like something that could not be done. All the odds were stacked against, and it wasn't like, you know, underdog rises from whatever. It was hard. I mean, it was process. It was, you had overwhelming public support, but still, it didn't change the fact that it was hard, and they were there. And I think it's interesting to watch that. It's not something that's like, ooh, this is tough. I mean, you'll cry. I mean, it's really, especially that Edmund Pettus bridge sequence is really tough to watch. But it just, it's emotional because it's, you see something that happened then, and it's like flashbacks, and you're seeing this Edmund Pettus bridge sequence, and you're like, wait, I watched this during the Ferguson protests. Like it's hauntingly similar.
And I don't feel it's exploitative either.
No, not
like,
at all.
Whereas I think Unbroken was very exploitative with its brutality. It's like, someone's being physically hurt. Don't you feel hurt as well? Like, this felt like, I never felt the film was exploitative. I never felt it was I felt it was just being honest. It wasn't going overboard, but it was painfully brutal, as it should be.
No, every shot is so carefully considered. I mean, that shot during the bridge sequence again, with Wendell Pierce just looking around, just bewildered at, like, you know, I expected it to be this bad, but Jesus, this is like a battlefield. I can't say enough good things about this movie. I think it's incredible.
And we were talking earlier last year about how, wow, I wonder what would have happened if Lee Daniels had stayed on to direct this. And Hugh Jackman plays the villain. And
Lenny Kravitz. I'm not, and Cedric the Entertainer, Robert De Niro, yeah. Liam Neeson.
I'm glad we didn't get that movie.
No. Well, and Ava said that when she came on, the existing script was tilted towards Lyndon B. Johnson. And understandably so. I mean, a lot of people feel like you need a white savior or a white character to guide scared white audiences through stories like this. And she was like, I'm a black filmmaker. I'm going to tell the black story. Like, this is the story I'm going to tell. So she did some work on the script and redid the focus. And that's the thing. There is no white savior character. There is no, you know, kind of nice white guy who's guiding you along saying, like, you know, people were racist, but some white people were good. It's very much the story of these people on the ground in Selma, and that doesn't make it difficult for me to connect to or watch as a Caucasian male.
Yeah, it's very pandering to say, like, I need my identification character. It's always so weird. It's like, people won't identify with a movie unless it's a white male.
Yeah,
I think that's the thing. It's only identify as a white male. I'm like,
J.J. Abrams was like, we'll see. Let's try Star Wars. Let's see what happens.
I mean, seriously, I just think that, for me, it's that notion is pretty much condescending to everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Whether you're white male or not, it's just like, I don't think anyone can really...
Or even male. It's like, guys won't connect with a female. We gotta,
exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Guys aren't able to... Guys won't see it if it's a lady. They won't do it.
Exactly, which is just, are these presumptions, and I think they come about because certain films fail, and then their failure is ascribed to the wrong reason. It's like, oh, well, this film, it wasn't that it was a bad fucking story, it was that it was female-led.
Well, let's also not be naive here. I think there are probably a significant number of male executives out there who are probably pretty misogynist.
I mean, I think they're misogynist. Look, I'm not denying the existence of those people, but at the same time, I do feel that money is the most important thing to all of these people. Like, you can set aside some your misogyny when you think that, oh, wow, well, then if our chicks coming to see movies now, well, fuck it, I don't care. Like, that's the thing. No, seriously, yeah. Like, I don't care. It's like, oh, wow, well, then get the ladies in the seats. You know, like, if Frozen makes $1 billion, you're like, you know what, maybe we will consider a female Ghostbusters now.
Yes,
that's apparently true. Women do see movies, who knew. So then again, Amy Pascal runs Sony, so but you understand my point.
Yes, I understand your point.
Selma is great. It went wide last Friday. Please go see it whether it gets nominated for Oscars or not. Go see Selma. It's not a dry history lesson. It's very powerful, but it's also not like a downer.
And also, not only see it for that, but see it to see one of the most exciting new filmmakers working today. It's really, and cinematographers, like, they're like, from a filmmaking standpoint, it is exciting.
There are so many reasons to see this movie. We are tired of giving you reasons.
Yes.
Now let's talk about a film that I think, to me, is an example of how I felt about 2014 in cinema, which is films that I really, really wanted to like and came up short, which was Inherent Vice. Inherent Vice I can put next to Interstellar as sort of like, oh man, this could be really crazy and really weird, and this is an exciting filmmaker, and oh boy, oh man. Like, Inherent Vice, I such a great cast, great trailer, but I will say that trailer for Inherent Vice pretty much has all the jokes in it. Has all of the easy jokes are in that trailer, except for a few of them.
I wouldn't say so. I think there are still plenty of jokes in the movie. I mean, a lot of the jokes
jokes are in the trailer.
I think a lot of the jokes are just Doc's reactions to things and how he's going along his life.
Yeah, but to me it's like, it's a joke. When I was looking at the humor in Inherent Vice, I felt like it was very sort of almost like a New Yorker cartoon. Like, now we shall have a laugh. We shall enjoy this absurd moment together, won't we? Like, it just didn't really embrace it. It was like very self-conscious of like sort of being like that Abram Zucker kind of movie. Like, I am making wacky things. Like, instead of just living in it, it was just very self-conscious in a way that I felt was distancing. Whereas opposed to Magnolia and Boogie Nights, which I feel are very lived in, there seems to be a distance, sort of this almost clinical observation of the world of Inherent Vice that really kept me at a distance.
You see, I didn't get that at all. I felt a closeness, actually, and the humor didn't feel, you know, self-conscious or anything like that to me. It felt like a movie that, and honestly, it was a movie that I went into expecting not to love, because I didn't love The Master. I respect The Master, and I respect it as an exercise from a filmmaker whose work I adore. And so I kind of thought that Anderson was going to continue on this kind of strange path with Inherent Vice, but I wasn't expecting it to be. I know people were comparing it to like Slapstick and the Zucker Brothers movies, but I wasn't necessarily expecting that, because I was like, it's still Paul Thomas Anderson, how slapstick can it get? But I just fell for it. I don't know, it's tough to explain, but I think it's a credit to the movie. I mean, if the movie is about kind of that one that you can't let go, that girl, that ex-girlfriend who always has that pull on you and brings you in, that's kind of what the movie was for me. I fell for it kind of not even knowing that I was falling for it, and just got sucked in. And so much of the filmmaking sucked me in. Just the way that Anderson was framing the shots and the way that it was structured was pulling me closer and closer and closer into the story, so that I felt like I was on this journey with Doc and not necessarily following along the plot. I was kind of in his headspace. I mean, a lot of the jokes are like, it's almost like you're watching like LA Confidential or some like pulp movie, but the lead character is a pothead And so you're following on his little deranged sidetracks and his, you know, in his mind, stuff that he thinks is, oh, this is a very worthwhile lead to follow. And the movie doesn't point out that it's, you know, this probably not going to pan out. So it just follows it seriously. And so I was kind of in it with him and following along with these things with him, knowing that it was kind of absurd, but enjoying the ride nonetheless.
See, maybe I just wasn't playing on the same level the film wanted me to play on, in that I was sort of accepting it as a mystery. And even though I understand it's kind of a play on the kind of noirish vibe, I understand that it's sort of trying to you know, mock it a little bit, the absurdities of these conventions of the detective genre. I mean, when you're talking about how, you know, that lost love and how you can't let it go, I feel that that is such a weak impetus. And it's just something where the misadventures of Doc Sportello, like, it's just sort of like, and then we made him do this wacky thing, and look at how all these people are crazy connected, and you have to pay super close attention, which to me, maybe you're not supposed to play close attention. Maybe you are supposed to get confused like Doc and just sort of like ride the wave of all these separate mysteries that kind of intersect, even if it's in an unrewarding fashion. And I think perhaps it's maybe a film that you're more meant to feel, like in terms of a vibe, because I feel as something driven by plot, it's very tedious. It's a tedious mystery.
I completely understand that, because I was not in it plot-wise. Like, I was interested in what was happening, but it was so much more of like, you meet Shasta, she's immediately transfixing, immediately like, wow, like she left an impression, she disappears, all right, so the impetus is to find her again. And the plot was secondary to just kind of these different characters and situations that he was falling into, and so I was enjoying him for that, not necessarily like, all right, now what was this, the Golden Fang, and what is that. I just kind of trusted that it was going to take me to a place that was satisfying, and to me it was, the way it kind of ended up. And it was more meeting these people along the way. It wasn't necessarily what they had to say with regards to the investigation, but just kind of what kind of character was this. I mean, a Bigfoot, Josh Brolin's Bigfoot, I think, I mean, it's a man out of time. He's got one foot in the 50s, another foot in one foot in the 60s, another foot in the 70s, and is just kind of having to deal with this shift, a guy that feels out of place. And I think it's just a series of people like that that are just kind of like, wow, like that was a really interesting person that I spent however many minutes with.
See, but I feel Bigfoot is sort of the exception. I feel Bigfoot because we keep spending time with him. I don't really know anything about Reese Witherspoon's character. Don't really know much about Owen Wilson's character. I mean, they pop up and they're this sort of, you know, interesting menagerie, these little snapshots, but I don't really know who they are. I don't really know any much about Benicio del Toro's character. They're just sort of there. They're sort of wallpaper. They're all, again, part of this milieu that Anderson wants to suck us into. And I think if the film works for you, I mean, this movie worked for a lot of people, and I really, really wish I could have been one of them. I really wanted to like this movie, but the more it went along, I'm like, I don't care. I just don't care what happens with this case. I am, and then perhaps there's a barrier that I think other people have, perhaps because of their personal connections. I think LA people have had a better connection with the film, anecdotally, because LA is such a character in the film. I don't really know LA that well. I think people who are familiar with the time period have a better connection with it. I think even as someone who isn't well versed in California in the 1970s, you get at least a sense of history in the film, which is good, but that still wasn't enough for me. And then if you're a Pynchon fan, which I'm not, his writing just doesn't really, I'm not saying he's a bad writer, I'm just not a fan of him. But if you are, this apparently the movie falls very closely to the book, so you have something else there. I understand why people latched onto Inherent Vice. There's the next movie we're going to talk about, a little more baffling, but Inherent Vice I get, but at the same time I'm like, this is impenetrable in a way that doesn't suck me in further. Like, usually for Anderson's past few films, for The Master and for There Will Be Blood, there was something I'm like, okay, I want to go on this ride again. In fact, I feel cheated that I only have to see this once and I don't get a free screening to see it again, because I need more than one viewing. With Inherent Vice, I feel that, yes, a second viewing would be more illuminating, but I don't want it. It's like Mulholland Drive. Like, okay, I'm sure this will come together even better on a second viewing, but I didn't enjoy the first viewing this much, all that much.
See, I don't think it, I think you should give it another shot and just not pay attention to the plot. See if you can get sucked in, because it's something that you just fall for, and you just, I don't know how to explain it. It's almost like Doc's relationship with Shasta is kind of how I felt in relation to the film itself. And like, I have no connection to L.A. I haven't read any Pynchon.
Right, and I'm not saying
I
those
just
are
fell into it. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, man. It's a movie that I really wanted to watch again. It's a movie that I wanted to be in that world longer, just because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with Doc and being in this world. Whereas The Master is something that I watched it and I was like, man, I don't know how to make heads or tails of this. I have so many theories.
Master does not hold up well.
Yeah, but what I was saying is that I had all these questions about it, but I had no desire to watch it again. Like, I know I need to see it again, but I don't want to, just because it was kind of
I totally get that. Whereas I feel the same way about The Master. There Will Be Blood, I can see that movie again.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
There Will Be Blood is a better version of The Master.
Yeah, and which is interesting, because listening to, I don't know if you listened to Paul Thomas Anderson's appearance on the WTF podcast with Mark Maron. But he's like super candid about his earlier films. He said he would cut the shit out of Magnolia Now. He's like, oh, it's unrelentingly long. But he looks really fondly on The Master, says he wouldn't change a thing about it. So I don't know. He's such an interesting filmmaker, because
I think we should interview him again in 10 years and see what he says about The Master.
Yeah, I think so too. I think he's he's certainly on an interesting path right now with these two films, because they're unlike anything he's made before. Like, There Will Be Blood felt like not a prestige picture, but his version of a prestige picture. But The Master was something totally different. And then Inherent Vice, I guess, is his version of a comedy. Yeah, it's just weird.
See, I feel like The Master is more of, and There Will Be Blood are kindred spirits. They're sort of these ethereal, aloof movies with that sort of weird Johnny Greenwood score and this sort of almost stark cinematography and these very disturbed characters. I feel that they're companion pieces almost, but There Will Be Blood works much better. I agree that Inherent Vice is definitely something different, although I would also say it has elements of all of his other movies in it.
Sure.
Sort of the period nature of Boogie Nights, sort of the weird love story of Punch Drunk Love, the weird confluence of events of Magnolia. The thing I will say about Inherent Vice, another thing I'll say about it, is that even though the film didn't work for me, it's not like, oh, that Paul Thomas Anderson, I think he's on his way down. I think people need to start telling him no. I like the film in terms of, this is definitely a director's vision. It's just a vision that doesn't work for me. I wish it did, but I am still going to be super excited to see what he does next.
You got to admit, Robert Elswit's cinematography is kind of incredible.
I'm not saying the film is like a failure on every level. Absolutely not.
I thought that's what you said. I'm sorry. I didn't understand.
Did I say it was a failure on every level?
No.
I think I'm not saying you did. I think that I'm just trying to make it clear for people. It's like, oh man, he didn't like Inherent Vice.
Sure.
I just hate everything about it. No, I do have to admit that Elswit's cinematography is quite spectacular in a year filled with terrific cinematography.
It's odd, because it feels like it's Anderson's most divisive film. I don't know if in retrospect, The Master is pretty divisive. When it first came out, I feel like people were kind of quick to praise it, even though they didn't really fully understand it, which, and certainly I was. Like, I thought that I liked it, and, you know, I thought that, you know, once I figured it out, I would like it even more, but looking back on it, it's a little odder. But yeah, like you said, I'm really eager to see what he's going to do next, because he's a filmmaker that he's doing his own thing. He's not like a Fincher who, you know, has a very specific voice and is an auteur, but it also enjoys playing around with films that a lot of people will see or enjoy, playing around with audiences' expectations. Like, Fincher makes films knowing I think with the intention of a wide audience seeing them, and maybe a percentage of that audience really getting what he's saying, and then kind of playing a joke on the rest of the people, because he's twisted and he's funny. I think Anderson is just like, I'm going to make what I'm going to make. If you like it, if you like it. If you don't, you don't.
As long as Megan Ellison is out there, I can do it.
Yes, yes. Very good. God bless Megan Ellison.
Right. And so, yeah, I like it. And I'll say this about Inherent Vice. I'm not opposed to watching it again. It's just, and maybe I will some years from now. I mean, I gave Punch Drunk Love another shot. Still don't like that movie at all.
I need to see that again. Because I did not. That's so far was the only one of his that I did not like. Just straight up didn't like upon first viewing.
Yeah, I still straight up don't like that movie. I wish I did, but I still don't.
Yeah.
But again, that's the thing. I respect the artistry of Inherent Vice, even if I felt that it was just a little too distant for me, a little too self-conscious. But it's not one of those movies where I look around and be like, you are crazy. There are some films where they're popular and it's like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Like I rewatched Forrest Gump the other night. And I'm like, holy shit, this was the most popular film of 1994. This film made a shit ton of money. And I know why, but at the same time, I'm like, really? We all accepted this as a great performance from Tom Hanks? Really? We all did this?
I like Forrest Gump, all right. I think it's fine.
It's not. I spent 2.5 hours last night learning it's not.
I've seen it a lot of times. Maybe I need to watch it again. I think it's fine. I do know that there's this new trend of, you know, saying it's the worst movie ever made, but
it's not the worst movie ever made.
I know you're not saying that, but there's a lot of people that are like, oh my god, this piece of garbage.
Yeah, it's totally hip to hate it now, for sure. But I do think that it's something where I don't know if it's aged well.
It's like the themes are troubling. I'll say that. It's kind of like, well, if you're a bad person, you're going to get AIDS and die.
If you're a woman.
If you're a woman. But basically, if you're a bad person, bad things will happen to you. But if you're a simpleton, and
if you just do what you're told,
yes,
things will work out all right.
Yeah.
And hey, everyone, remember the baby boomer generation? Fucking baby boomer. That's a weird film, though. I would encourage people to listen to the Canon podcast because it's great, and they're currently discussing Forrest Gump, and they have some really interesting things to say on it. That's Amy Nicholson and Devin Faraci. Definitely check out the Canon podcast. This one's good, too. Thanks for listening to it. And we're going to now continue with American Sniper, a film that I think is terrible.
It is terrible.
By the way, let me just be clear. This isn't like, oh, the film was okay, and then it started picking up awards buzz, and then I really disliked it. It wasn't one of those cases where a film gets harsher critique because it is now taking off. Like, Adam, you know these films. Like, there are these films that are, like, they're fine and they're fun, and then they get burdened with awards recognition,
yeah,
and now you start really hating them.
That's the destiny of Imitation Game and Theory of Everything, I imagine. I think the same thing happened to The King's Speech for a sign, but that's a movie that I didn't like even on first viewing.
Right. But like The Artist is now like, how did that trifle ever, you know? It's like, it's a fine movie. I like The Artist.
I have to be reminded that that movie exists, not let alone won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor.
Precisely.
Oh, God.
Precisely.
what
but that's
were
no
we thinking?
Fault of the, well, we weren't. But that's no fault of the film itself. But
no,
but
the film was fine.
But my point is that American Sniper is bad from the word go. It is a terrible film. It is to me, American Sniper is, I don't know, it may be the most precise reminder of how little Clint Eastwood gives a shit.
Yes.
Because some people are saying like, oh, this is a pro war on terror movie. It's very pro war on terror. And I'm like, to be pro anything requires effort. And I don't think Clint Eastwood could care about. I almost wish this was a pro war on terror film. Not because I agree with that view, but because it would show some kind of thought and investment. And I don't see any of that in American Sniper.
Yeah, it would have a point of view.
Except from Bradley Cooper, who worked for years to get this movie made, and he is trying his damnedest. And Clint Eastwood is like, you know,
you got it in one take, Brad.
Like, he is really good. He's like, well, Clint, this baby looks pretty fake. No, it's fine. What if I jiggle its arm with my thumb? Whatever you want to do, Bradley. Okay.
Whatever you want to do. I'm going to get this film in on time and under budget.
Yeah. And I don't like saying movies are terrible. I think a lot of times it's overblown and people have, you know, too intense of a reaction.
Hyperbole is fun, Adam.
Yeah.
Hyperbole.
But this movie is really bad. It's really bad. And not, you know, not just thematically, but just, you know, as a movie that exists in the world, it's bad.
That was made by a professional filmmaker,
yeah,
at a major studio, starring with a movie star, with material that once attracted the attention of Steven Spielberg. This is not like, oh, it's a shitty indie film that got a little bit of money. Okay, this is a real movie, and it's really bad.
And what's so frustrating is it could have been so great. There are multiple interesting stories to be told from Chris Kyle's life and from Chris Kyle's story, none of which are touched on in this in this film.
Or
none
the way
of them.
That they're told. Like, there's a lot of, you know, he may have made up a lot of shit.
Yeah.
About his life. And to me, like, that's fascinating. Because what does that say about what we want from American heroes?
Yeah.
And to me, when I hear that kind of stuff, I'm like, I get flashbacks to good Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, a film that I love, where it's like the author builds himself up as this sort of warrior that he's not. But that would be complex. And then, of course, you would inevitably draw on the people. It's like, Clint Eastwood hates the troops. This movie hates the troops. Hate, hate, hate the troops. You hate America. So on and so forth. And it's like, okay, well, here's a movie about a guy who killed a lot of brown people. That's the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know why I should give a shit about Chris Kyle other than he killed a lot of people. Like, that's it. It's like the most, you know, the most lethal sniper in America. I'm like, okay, he killed like 160 people. This film doesn't even really go into the depth of what that would do to the human psyche.
And that's the thing. Like, when I first heard this movie was going to be made, and especially when Spielberg was going to do it, I was like, that's fascinating. Like, what it must have been like to be the person who killed 160 people. I don't care if those 160
women and including women and children.
Including women and children. I don't care if those people are all like Adolf Hitler clones. Like, you killed a human being. Like, what does that do to oneself? Like, what does that do to one's psyche? What is that impact? None of which is touched on in this movie.
And as a sniper, I mean, that's actually another level to it, because if it's someone like in the heat of battle or like someone dropping bombs, like there's a distance there, whereas a sniper has all the power, really. They are unseen, but they're on the battlefield. They have to look their target in the face and kill them. That has a lot of weight to it. An American sniper is like, yeah, he killed some people. And he killed a lot, and we should respect that. I'm like, why? Why should we respect that?
Not even we should respect that. We shouldn't consider that. Like, we and it, like, there are half-assed attempts at kind of questioning where some of his fellow troops are kind of like, you know, I don't know what we're doing here, and, you know, I don't know what the mission is anymore. And he's like, you can't think about that. You gotta think about your thing. And I understand the difficulty from if I'm stepping into Bradley Cooper's shoes as a producer, as someone who has worked so hard to get this movie made, is passionate about telling his story, meets with Chris Kyle's family, they straight up tell him, don't fuck up my son's story, he knows what kind of people they are. You feel indebted to tell Chris Kyle's story as is.
As they wanted to have it.
As they will, I mean, which is the book, American Sniper, which... And this is not speculation. There have been lawsuits against the book for inaccuracies and embellishments. And
the movie feels like embellishments upon embellishments.
Yeah, and so to take that at face value and just be like, well, here's the story that he told about himself. We're going to tell that. And, you know, we're not really going to consider anything else beyond that. It's just disappointing. And I know I read a long interview with Jason Hall, the screenwriter, who said when he worked with Spielberg initially, Spielberg really wanted to flesh out the role of I don't even remember his name, because Clint Eastwood doesn't care, the evil brown sniper you know,
Mustafa.
Yeah, Mustafa. Essentially, there's got to be an antagonist, so there's another sniper that's a
they have their own handsome sniper.
Yeah, and Spielberg was really interested in fleshing that character out and going into who was that, what did it mean to Chris Kyle, all this other stuff. I don't know what else they were going to get into, but that's in and of itself, like, that's a good start by just considering that these people are human beings and not video game characters. But yeah, that's too much.
I feel, though, that the film really does it is constantly honoring him. It is a hagiography to the point where, I mean, the closing credits are like, it's like this guy, it's like something reserved for like a president. Like a freaking national figure died. Sorry, everyone, he died.
It's not shown in the movie, so it's not a spoiler.
It's not shown in the... Is it a spoiler? I don't think it's a spoiler. It's tragic in the most ham-fisted way. But the film is, it's like, you know, everyone, you know, look at how decorated his coffin was. Look at how many people loved him. And I'm like, why? I get it, because his sniping killed people and therefore saved lives. But that is an action. That is something you're telling me. This doesn't tell me who he is as a human being. That tells me what he did. But how does that reflect on who he was as an individual? Because at that point, you may as well just honor a fucking tank. You may as well just honor a weapon. Because that's what he is. He's a weapon.
Yeah. And what is it like for a human to be used as a weapon? Like, that's interesting to consider. Even going to, you know, when he came home, he had PTSD. Kind of touches on that, but doesn't really delve into it.
It's manifested in the most superficial manner possible.
Yeah, but...
Like, he gets startled by loud noises.
But he devotes his life to helping other veterans who have PTSD. That's interesting. Like, what is the motivation behind that? Why is it that the only way that this guy can deal with his PTSD is to help other people? Like, that's a noble thing that he did, and to delve into that would have been interesting. Even so, nope, too much. Can't dig too deep.
Here's the thing. I would almost wish this film did something, even if I, like, okay, so you and I were laying out all these things, like, well, at least it could have done this, at least it could have done that, at least it could have done this. If the film had done anything, even if I was like, I disagree with what you're doing, that would be something.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it doesn't do a damn thing. It's just there. It's a movie that's there. And I look at Clint Eastwood, and I'm like, you just fill time. That's all you do. This is a hobby for you. And because your movies don't cost very much to make, and because you have the prestige, and because famous actors will work with you, we're just going to let you keep doing it, Clint. And I'm sorry, like, Clint Eastwood is a legend, and nothing will change that. And I love, you know, some of his movies, but I think Unforgiven is one of the greatest westerns ever made. One of the most important westerns ever made.
Yeah.
But Clint Eastwood is probably one of the worst major directors working today. Like, you wouldn't necessarily think to put him in the same breath as someone like, you know, Paul W.S. Anderson or John Moore or anyone else, but, like, he doesn't give a shit. Like, what does that say about a director who doesn't care enough that the baby, the fake baby, looks so fake? Like, how much more does a real fake baby cost, really?
It's just mind-boggling. I had a conversation with someone on Twitter. I was like, what kind of filmmaker looks at that baby and says, oh, yep, that's fine? And he said, a filmmaker who says one take and done. Like, that's it. That's good enough.
Right, exactly. And look, neither of us is saying, like, you got to be Fincher or nothing. Like,
no
one's expecting him to do 100 takes. But when you're, like, one and done, like, to me, that's not even... It would almost be one thing. It's like Clint just wants it in the moment. He doesn't want them to overthink it. He just wants them to go for it. But it's something where I'm watching there, and I'm like, no, that's like someone saying I wrote a first draft of whatever I'm writing and didn't double-check it at all because I just wanted it to be raw and in the moment. You're just being lazy. That's what you are. You're being lazy.
Yeah, that's the thing. I used to think that, like, his one take thing, it was like, well, maybe it's like getting something special or whatever. But when you look at, like, his film as a whole now, I'm not talking about Unforgiven, but, like, his films now, it just seems more like a manifestation of laziness. Just, you know, it's good enough. We're done. You know, we're okay. I know that on the set of Mystic River Mystic River has some really fantastic performances. That cast got together every single night and did rehearsals on their own. That's why. Because Clint would do one take or one or two takes. And they didn't, like, say, like, oh, why won't you give us more takes? It was just kind of like he gave them their blessing. He was like, if you want to do that, you can do it. And I think that is why those performances are so good. I don't know. It's just so – it's so odd. And, like – Matt, like you were saying, like I don't want this movie to agree with me. I don't want this movie to tell me things that I say, like, oh yes, I agree with that. I want it to care. I want it to tell an interesting story, and it doesn't do those things.
I was just looking at American Sniper. I'm like, oh, so this is what shitty Hurt Locker is.
Yeah.
This is really shitty Hurt Locker. I was like, oh, he keeps going back to war, but why? Oh, it's because he's such a great guy. Because he's a hero. Like, that doesn't tell me dick about anything as a human being, as a portrait of the world, as something about the war on terror. That doesn't tell me anything. That's just like, if you kill enough people, you get yourself, and write a book, you get yourself a movie. Like, is that really, like, what is this? And I think, going back to what we started talking about like award seasons exacerbating things, yes, I disliked this movie before award season, but now that it's getting attention, now I'm really pissed off.
It's mind-boggling. It bottles the mind.
It really does, because, well, first off, this film is, like, still only in 4 movie theaters. Like, it'll open wide on Friday, but from 4 theaters, it's made, domestically, it's made $3 million
yeah,
since Christmas.
It's doing gangbusters business.
From whom? That's the thing. It's like, what? I mean, I guess, I mean, hey, those TV spots are quite good. The marketing team is doing a bang-up job. So yeah, I don't understand American Sniper, and it's one of those things where now it's taken that position in the race where the Oscar is on, like, just go away. Go away, American Sniper. Stop bothering people and let Selma come in. Like, that's the thing. I think it ties into movies I want people to see. And you reminded me today that Selma and American Sniper both premiered at AFI Fest. Selma got great response. American Sniper muted.
Yeah, it was, and like, yet, so-so. It was politely positive, a few intense negative reactions.
And then, but now here we are, and it's like, people are like, I want to see the guy who snipes people. And it's like, well, there's a film over here that's really remarkable in many ways, but is the guy handsome and a hero? Well, he is a hero, but did he kill a lot of brown people? Well, no, he wasn't. But was he the most lethal sniper in America? Well, no, but I don't know what that means in American Sniper. I don't know what that means in American Sniper. I don't know what this movie... This is what we're talking about. I don't get it. What emotional hook, unless you're like, America, fuck yeah. Like, and it's almost like just a... I'm looking at this, and I start to wonder, if Clint Eastwood had directed Lone Survivor, does Lone Survivor make a bigger splash in the awards race?
Because, yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I still go back to the trailers. I think that the marketing team is doing an incredible job. I think those trailers are fantastic and evocative and make you think that it's going to be a complex story. Because that first trailer, that's like that. I was like, oh, if this is an encapsulation of the whole movie, that's perfect. Because it's this debate over, like, do I shoot, do I not shoot? Like, what's going on? This is awful. That's just not in the movie. And I've told so many people that the movie's so bad, and they're like, but does it get in? And I've told them that, like, it doesn't get into any of that complexity, and they're like, really? Because the trailers make it look like, and I'm like, yeah, they're incredibly misleading.
Yes, trailers can be misleading, everyone.
Yes.
And it goes both ways. I saw the trailers for Paddington make the movie look quite terrible, and actually the movie's very good.
I think those trailers are good. I laughed. I don't know what
you
you're
like the Paddington
about.
Trailers?
Yes.
All right.
I thought they were cute.
Well, the movie is cute, so it worked. In that case, for you, the trailers are accurate. But American Sniper, kudos, most misleading trailer since Prometheus.
Prometheus was okay. They're not. I wouldn't say it's the most misleading. It's one of the most misleading. Well,
Prometheus's marketing is far better than the movie.
Sure. I'm saying that I don't think the trailers are intentionally misleading. Like, they're like, oh, like, he's having trouble over, like, this shot or whatever. But it's not the complexity of, like, killing someone. It's like, do they have a bomb or not? Like, I'm totally cool killing this woman and child if they have a bomb. But if they don't, that's kind of troubling.
Right, exactly. It's no, it's okay. I'll kill a kid. Just make
sure
he has
I'll feel bad about him.
Make sure he has a grenade that's half his size.
Yeah.
So everyone knows he's a really bad kid.
I'll feel bad if I kill the kid, but you know, good guys gotta get the bad guys.
Good guys gotta get the bad guys.
That's how it goes.
That's the moral complexity.
Those are the rules.
Yeah. It's like it's almost like a wish, almost maybe it's a wish fulfillment thing. It's like, man, I wish the war on terror was this simple. I really wish it really was this simple. It's like, oh, there are good guys and there are bad guys, and the good guys kill the bad guys, and yeah, I think we're done here. All right, good way to save the day. I find it infuriating. It's doubly infuriating because it manages, I guess, to be pro war on terror without even giving a shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, yeah.
Gosh. So American Sniper. That's a shame, and I think, well, we'll talk Oscars later. We'll talk Oscars later, but I just kind of hope it slides away. I mean, I think at this point I'm resigned to it getting nominated for Best Picture, but hopefully it'll lose steam, maybe.
We'll see.
We'll see. Oh, my goodness. All right, so let's pick things back up, and let's finish off with, as we've just trashed American Sniper for a solid 20 minutes, let's end up with some positivity. Let's end with recommendations. Adam, what do you got for us?
Well, fresh off today's somewhat disheartening news of the Directors Guild nominations, though not without something super pleasant, which is Wes Anderson getting a DGA nod and probably an Oscar nomination, which is fantastic. David Fincher was left off, which I don't think a ton of people were expecting him. But it got me thinking, man, I really want to see a new David Fincher movie. And, you know, he's spending all of this year working on this HBO series. Bam! News breaks. David Fincher is directing a remake of Strangers on a Train, starring Ben Affleck, written by Gillian Flynn, called Strangers on a Plane. And it's going to be great. So I am recommending the original Strangers on... Well, one of the original Strangers on a Train, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, who created one of his more notable pieces of work with this movie. It's a classic Hitchcock premise. Two strangers meet on a train, spoiler alert, a young tennis player and a charming psychopath. They, of course, the tennis player doesn't know that the other man is a psychopath at first, but they kind of discuss lightly about each of them wanting to get rid of someone. And the psychopath suggests, well, what if I get rid of your person for you? You get rid of my person for me? Then we can never get caught since we're strangers. It's perfect. It's kind of a joke. Except the psychopath ends up getting rid of the other man's certain someone, which leaves him in a bit of a bind in that he is not a psychopath and is not willing to murder someone. So it turns into this kind of cat and mouse chase a little bit with a super crazy psychopath. Played by Robert Walker in a really excellent creepy role. It's a fun movie. It's not one of my favorites of Hitchcock's, but there's a particular set piece that is kind of famous, set at a carousel, kind of a fight struggle sequence that's really entertaining. Basically, it's fun. It's one of those classic, you know, Hitchcock hooks. Has a really hooky premise, and I cannot wait to see Fincher's version, because I mean, it's an incredibly fruitful premise. So if you think of Fincher doing a loose version of it, a loose adaptation, in this version, Ben Affleck plays an actor in the midst of an Oscar campaign. So also kind of relevant for today.
Based on the events of Argo.
Based on the events of Argo and also The Social Network, Fincher's experience campaigning for that Best Director Oscar that went to Tom Hooper.
Did he campaign? I think for Social Network, wasn't he busy on Dragon Tattoo? Like, he's just like, fuck it, I don't want to campaign.
He was busy on Dragon Tattoo, but he did the campaign anyway, kind of reluctantly. He did his first big campaign for Ben Button, got nominated all his time, reluctantly did the Social Network won, and I remember his Golden Globe speech when he won the Golden Globe, and he was like, I'm actually kind of warming up to this. He was like, this is not good. kind of saying that he's kind of enjoying it. And then, oh, you know, Tom Hooper wins. It's okay because he's made incredible films after that.
Right. And I think the larger point is that campaigning for awards drives you to murder.
Yes, basically. So you're all listening. You're all going to see David Fincher's version because it's going to be great. Who isn't? So I suggest you see Hitchcock's version first. I don't think they're going to be that similar. Hitchcock's version itself was based on a novel of the same name by Patricia Highsmith. So if you want to check that out, you might. But yeah, Strangers on a Train. It's probably a movie you should see if you're into movies. It's entertaining, thrilling, a lot of fun, and great set pieces. So check it out.
I agree. I actually like it quite a lot. But my recommendation is going to be Tootsie.
Tootsie, go.
That actually is straight from the soundtrack.
Yeah.
The audio quality is quite poor. But the 1982 Sidney Pollack comedy Tootsie, which is the funniest film you'll ever see about rampant gender inequality. The film stars Dustin Hoffman as a struggling out-of-work actor who is kind of a diva, but he's also kind of a perfectionist. And he is just trying to find work. And his friend slash student, Sandy, played by Terry Garr, tries to get a part in a soap opera, but she's not right for the role, but he thinks he will be. So he dresses up like a woman, goes under the name Dorothy Michaels, and gets the part. But that means he has to keep dressing up like a woman. And as a woman, he starts seeing the world entirely differently. And it's a film that's very funny, but not silly. It's very wry and observant, and there is the absurdity of it. It's a guy dressing up as a woman so that he can get an acting job, but it's very earnest and sort of, I think, if it is absurd, it acknowledges the absurdity of the world and the things we allow to exist and the roles that we play, not just in terms of acting, because I think acting is also just one of the big themes of the film, the role, but the roles we play as men, as women, as and with each other, as people in romantic relationships, and the lies we tell to each other in terms of, oh, you know, I don't want to hurt her feelings, or if I just behaved this way, and oh, he's really like that, and these sort of shows we put on for each other that are defined by the gender roles we just automatically accept. And I think by playing into this, the film is very smart, but it's also very funny, consistently, very well acted. Dustin Hoffman, of course, being top of his game. And I feel that it's a film that is still fascinating, depressingly relevant. I don't look at Tootsie and go, man, this sure is outdated. I guess, really, the most outdated thing in Tootsie I'm looking at, I'm like, but how would Dorothy Michaels file her W-2s? Like, that was my big thing about the alternate identity, about how that would work. Because everything else is just disturbingly familiar, even though this film is over 30 years old. And I just think it's just a really a marvelous film. And if for no other reason, I think the tomato scene, even though it doesn't go into the whole gender roles thing, the scene where Dustin Hoffman is talking with his agent, who is played by Sidney Pollack, and they're discussing why he couldn't keep a job playing a tomato, is brilliant. And I think the intensity of it, Adam knows what I'm talking about, and it's great. And so the film recently went onto Criterion, which means it's packed with features, has an amazing transfer. So I highly recommend checking out Tootsie.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is the Criterion good?
Criterion's great.
That's a dumb question, but
there have been Criterions that are kind of weak. I mean, I'm still waiting for that Blue is the Warmest Color Criterion that actually has special features on it.
That hasn't happened. We'll see. It took like 4 years for Fantastic Mr. Fox, even though like almost every Wes Anderson movie is like immediately on Criterion.
Well, we're going to have to wait a while for Moonrise Kingdom as well. They say that's coming this year, though.
Yeah. There's that little doodle. It's usually like 2 years. Wes Anderson movies are 2 years usually.
I can live with that. But definitely check out Tootsie, rent it, buy it. If you buy the Criterion, you won't be throwing your money away, that's for sure. But anyway, if you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
@AdamChitwood.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.